You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
This is Lekka. I'm Lucy Dearlove. This month on Lekka Book Club, an interview in the kitchen of Anna Ansari, the author of Silk Roads, A Flavour Odyssey, with recipes from Baku to Beijing.
With that and with the dishes especially, I wanted to make sure that they are a nod to not just my heritage, but to my present, right? Like, what do I cook on a daily basis? What can you cook in your kitchen in Hastings, in London, in Edinburgh, in Manchester, in New York, and wherever, you know? Like, how can we sort of bring these flavors and these experiences into our homes, onto our tables in ways that are accessible while simultaneously, like, stimulating, you know, not just your taste buds, but like potentially your perception of the food that you're eating and its origins.
Anna Ansari lives in East London now, but has made it there via suburban Detroit, China, New York City, and Scotland. She's Iranian American and fell in love with China first during a study abroad summer as a teenager, then spending the next decade of her life going back and forth between there and the US. After spending the next period of her life as an NYC trade attorney, she moved to the UK to be with her husband and began slowly making the connections between the history of the world's most famous trade routes and her own personal family story. In Silk Roads, Anna draws together ingredients and narrative threads from across Asia in a way I found both surprising and illuminating. I joined Anna and her cat Enzo in the kitchen of her Walthamstow house while she prepared lunch for us from the book. Risotto alla Bucarese. Yes, risotto. We'll get into that.
This book has gone on its own long journey. But I really started in summer of, what was that, summer 2021? Maybe. I submitted a proposal for the Yankit So Award on new food writers in Asia about how I wanted to sort of trace Turkic food from my father's background and like childhood in Iran through to the Uyghur neighborhoods that I spent a lot of time as a teen and then a young adult in modern day, you know, big cities in China. So I submitted this proposal, which, you know, resulted in me getting a literary agent who then was like, this is great, no one's going to buy it. But at that time, I had also been doing a lot of recipe testing for Olea Hercules. And yes, and so she was the one actually who encouraged me to submit an essay, to submit this project to the Yankit So Awards, because I, you know, it was COVID. We just like, you know, started chatting online and end up, I took all of her online workshops and I recipe tested for her and I would send my feedback on the recipes to her. You know, yes, this was delicious. Yes, this was also delicious. Everything's delicious, but where's the salt and yada, yada, yada. And her responses were, your descriptions in your recipe testing feedback are so funny and so fun and so lyrical. You're just a born storyteller. So she basically encouraged me not only to submit a, you know, piece for this award, but also to do an essay for her book, which she included in Home Food. And then we developed a recipe for that as well. So she was really integral to that process and just sort of saying, like, you've got a lot to say and someone should hear it. So try to write it down. And I've been such a fan of her writing as well as her recipes for so long.
Yeah, that's quite an endorsement.
Yeah, it really meant a lot. And so after I got an agent, basically, she said, well, listen, what would you think about turning this idea into a cookbook? We know you cook. We know you know how to recipe test. What are your thoughts on this? And I hemmed and hawed a bit, to be honest. I was like, I just want to write like narrative nonfiction. But I do love cooking and I love, you know, being very precise with quantities. Like I think that coming from a legal background, actually, like writing a recipe is very important to me, that I have everything like lined up properly and I have the steps correct and nothing's left out. I'm just very, very precise. And so I knew I could do it. And so that's how this sort of just came about. And I started doing the research on the different cuisines and recipes. And I mean, I think that entire process was about 2 years. And then from basically signing with DK until publication date is another 2 years. So 4 years of work and yeah. you know, in one hey, little turquoise and sort of reddish package.
Gorgeous cover, yeah. yeah. I'm so interested by that kind of writing journey, for want of a better phrase, because, you know, you have had, in so many ways, like quite an extraordinary life, like in terms of where you've lived, where you've traveled, the experiences you've had, you know, reading your Substack, the stories that you have from all these different places. But I'm so interested that you sort of started writing this late, if you know what I mean. Was there yeah. never an inclination before that?
I mean, I think there was. I think, you know, I know there was. I remember as a teenager, I was like, I just want to like write books. Like, this is what I wanted. That's what I wanted. And then I got so immersed into Chinese history and culture. Mm. And I really had, you know, a good decade of devotion to an entire region. And, you know, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. But it wasn't really a chance to sort of sit back and write. And some of the things maybe I wanted to write about those experiences in China, I would have, like, not wanted my parents to hear about, or, sure, the government. Sure. I mean,
like, there's a lot at stake.
There's still some stuff that I don't, you know. There is a lot at stake. And I think that, you know, as a young adult, maybe that was too much for me to have yeah. at stake. And I thought, okay.
It's a lot to have out there in the
world.
It
is a lot to yeah. have out there. It's a, you know, there's a lot in this book that's extremely personal. There's a lot that's really historical and culinary, but there's a lot of my family in there. There's a lot of me. And I sort of am at the point in my life where I just don't care.
It's great. That's very liberating.
No, it is really liberating. Yeah. And I think that I'm not trying to prove anything to anyone yeah. other than to just let my voice be heard for yeah. maybe the first time, and sort of be really okay with sort of how people interpret that as well. And just say, okay, you know, like, here I am. Hope you enjoy. And I really do hope you enjoy, because I think you will. But, you know, it's nice to finally get to the point in life where that's the attitude I have. Mm. Whereas when I was in my late 20s and I had this like great job that I liked, but I didn't make any money. Mm. So I thought, okay, well, I'll go to law school. You know, I went to law school. I still am in debt for that. I made some money. I'm still in debt. But it wasn't this great passion project. It's not a great way to have to choose your life, but it's a lot of, you know, a lot of us, that is how we make these decisions.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it has to be pragmatic.
It has to be pragmatic. It wasn't the plan, but I, you know, it paid me well. It paid me well until I used up all my money traveling to visit my now husband in the UK.
Sure, sure. Like,
well, this is not going to work.
And then you moved here and you can't practice law here.
That is very correct. So, and I'm still in debt. Like, I think about this. I think one of the reasons I am so passionate about this book is not only what is between, you know, this beautiful cover, but for what it means to me, is that I did move here. And like so many immigrants across time and space, you know, I've given up my profession to move to a new country, to make a new start, to have a new family. It is the sacrifices that you make. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, the sacrifices you make when you move sometimes. Oh, wow. Sorry. No, and it's really important, but it's been a real struggle moving here and realizing, you know, I worked so hard, even if it was not a career that I totally loved, like I was good at it and I worked really, really hard.
Yeah.
To not have that and to have worked so hard for so many years to get yeah. to a place where you're successful in your career and to be told that is no more. So for me, this is really also, you know, it's a big deal for me, this book, because it is a journey of career-wise and to get, hopefully, you know, I loved writing this book and I have ideas for more. So I want to be able to sort of not have another career sort of nipped in the bud.
So I read, maybe in an interview you did, that you were, quote, sent to China as a teenager.
I was.
Because you had attended a language program in possibly Switzerland previously. And you had been caught behaving inappropriately, badly, mm-hmm. however we want to put it. And your family had forbidden you from pursuing that particular language program again. And they thought you would have to behave better in China. And so that's what happened. Is that correct? Tell me about that.
That is correct. I blame my little sister, Sarah, for this situation. Thank you. You set me on the course that I'm on in my life. I did. I got caught drinking and smoking when I was like 14 years old. And it was like in the late 90s and we were running around, you know, relatively unsupervised outside of like Stade and Chateau Day. And we were supposed to be practicing in French. And we were. I knew how to like order a Malibu and Coke.
Right. Back in Marlboro Lights.
Yes, exactly. My younger sister definitely told on me. I remember the phone booth in the center of the village square. And Sarah being like on the phone, because she was, I think, 13, maybe 12. Anyway, and she, by the way, crazy that.
I was just thinking, so young to be on the other side of the world.
Yes, before cell phones and everything.
Right, different time.
Yeah. But I remember Sarah on that little square in Rougemont calling my parents and being like, Anna was drinking and she smoked a cigarette. And they were like, what? Like, okay, well, this is, we'll deal with that when you come home. You better be learning your French, you know, so you can get into a good university. But so the following summer, I wanted to go back to Europe. I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Detroit. Nowadays, Detroit's a bigger city, but it certainly wasn't then, and I'm from the suburbs. I really just wanted to go to Europe. Mm. I was like, this is the bee's knees, like how very sophisticated. And that was just shot down. They were like, you are not going back to those Europeans and their boozy ways.
They're not wrong.
But in any case, my parents, you know, this was summer of 1997, and basically, they handed me these two brochures and they're like, you pick, you go to China or you go to Japan. And wow. I refused to pick. I was like, if I say nothing, they'll let me go to Italy, right? In retrospect, I think that if I had done a little bit more research, I probably would have picked Japan simply because, I don't know, because it was less of an unknown because China was an unknown. Like, this is 1997. I like to say Bill Clinton was alive. Bill Clinton was president. Yeah. Princess Diana was alive. Bill Clinton was alive. He's still alive.
Still alive.
But by the way, this was pre-Monica Lewinsky. Like, this was before that.
When you put it like that.
Yes. Like, this was way back when.
Yeah.
But so I didn't pick, and my parents picked China. They said, you know, well, we're going to China for the summer, and we think that this is going to be an interesting region. We think that this is going to be an important area to learn about. And also, this will look really good on your college applications. And I was just in tears. I was just like bawling my face off. I remember getting onto the plane, crying, getting onto the plane. And they just let me go. They were just like, well, there you go. You're getting on the plane in tears.
And so how long were you going away for?
I was 6 weeks.
Wow. That's a long time.
Yeah, I was 15. Shanghai, summer of 1997. And I have to say, I remember arriving in Shanghai and walking out of this airport that's no longer used and just being so overwhelmed. And I remember my eyes just like bulging out of my head and like my face just breaking into some massive grin. It was like the coolest place I'd ever been from like literally moment one, like not day one, like second one. It was like the doors opened and this whole new world presented itself to me. And I was like, where the H am I? And I never want to go. I never want to leave. This is the cool, this is amazing.
Hi.
Hey, Ant. What's up, kitty cat? All right.
All right.
We are going to make some risotto.
When you said you were going to make this, and I hadn't fully read I skimmed the rice chapter, put it that way, when I was kind of plowing through the book to do some research.
Fair.
And I went back to it and I was like, oh, this is so interesting. Because my immediate reaction was risotto in a book about Asia.
Oh, I have two risottos.
But you explain perfectly. And it comes back to the origins of rice and the origin of an ingredient that was native to this continent, essentially, and then traveled to, I mean, you talk about it traveling to Spain, where it becomes paella, and traveling to Italy along with saffron, which very much not an Italian ingredient, has many things that are now, you know, commonly cooked with in that country. Tell us about this risotto.
This risotto I have named risotto alla bucarese.
And this is a name of your own imagining.
This is my own imagining. And this dish is my own imagining as well. And like, you know, this book is not an archive of recipes. There are none of them supposed to be definitive. I feel like that's really, there are no that's a whole conversation about authenticity and definitive recipes and whatnot. But a lot of the recipes are my takes on things. And this is my take on something that is a Bukharan Jewish dish called sabzi bakash. I actually don't know how to pronounce it, which sabzi means herbs in Persian. Gourmet sabzi is one of the most sort of beloved Iranian dishes, this very deeply green herby stew with kidney beans and lamb or beef and dried limes. And sabzi means herbs, which just means herbs. So sabzi comes from the Persian, and so did the Bukharan Jews.
Right.
So did the Bukharan Jews, who, you know, the Iran and the Persian Empire over, you know, centuries has a very, 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 very deep Jewish history. Actually, it's been a very, like, multi-ethnic, multi-religious place until relatively recently. As with so many other political changes, sometimes empires come in or new rulers and they kind of persecute. Mm-hmm. And at some point in time, I think it was in the Sasanian Empire, Judaism was not welcomed in Iran. And so you had a lot of immigrants. You had a lot of migration of Jews across Central Asia. And a lot of them, a big number, settled in Bukhara, in Uzbekistan, where you can still find a very thriving Jewish community there. And this dish, well, they basically were coming from Iran, where there you have all these like sabzi, green herby dishes, and moving to Uzbekistan. Basically, this is a dish that you would prepare on the Sabbath. In Judaism, you know, you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath, and that includes turning on any sort of utensil, or your cooking implements or whatnot. So what they would do traditionally is apparently cook this dish, which is a lot of herbs and meat and rice, in a sheep's stomach, a special kind of bag that you would hang and sort of like a slow, like slow cook it overnight so that you could, you know, have it started before the sun goes down on Friday. You could have your Shabbat meal and then eat it the next day on the Sabbath without and it'd be nice and warm and ready to go without having done any work.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't have one of these sheep's stomach and I'm not Jewish. So I just really wanted to learn about this dish, and that was my whole goal when I was researching, like, Bukharan cuisine specifically. One of the many things that went across the Silk Roads was religion. As the people went, so too did religion. You had Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Islam, Zoroastrianism. Like, there's so much. I mean, you can see it in the arts, you see it now, and I wanted to make sure that it came out in the cuisine as well, to have something that is representative of not representative of what we typically think of as Muslim food in this area.
Yeah.
That there are these other peoples and cuisines who have different religious inclinations, religious beliefs. Mm. And so that's this, but I couldn't figure out how to make it because I don't have a sheep stomach. And then when I was in Bukhara, there was a cooking class announced saying Jewish Plov cooking class here.
And you were like,
and I was like, sold. And it was down the street from a very old and still working synagogue. Also on the same little alley, there is one of the only Hebrew schools in all of Central Asia.
Wow,
there's
incredible.
This still very, very thriving community that's been there for centuries. Even throughout the Soviet era, you know, this was not a religion or a community that was silenced. Mm-hmm. And a lot of traditions remain, including, you know, Jewish cooking class, which did not use a sheep stomach. It basically, what they taught in this class was to kind of make this dish a la a risotto. And I say that a la a risotto in that, you know, when you make a traditional, or what we consider to be a traditional risotto, it's the slow addition of stock, of hot stock to a pan and letting the rice grains absorb it and then adding some more and sort of staying there slowly doing it. This was like a couple of big drops of water. Like, pour in a ton of water, then the rice absorbs it, then pour in some more, and the rice absorbs it. But I figured, you know what? A fun way of sort of showing how this dish evolved, not only in my conception of it and my book, was to sort of just make it like how I know how to make a risotto, but use the flavors and the ingredients that are traditional both to that dish and also a little bit to sabzi plov, which is the Iranian dish that is an herbed rice that you typically serve around, well, I mean, I would typically serve it every day if I could, but it is traditional for Iranian New Year. So it's sort of my combination Bukhara Jewish rice, sabzi plov, and risotto a la Bucharese, because I've learned over the course, as Lucy, as you mentioned, over the course of this research, that risotto a la Milanese exists, that like bright, almost technicolor saffron risotto that we so associate with this like capital of fashion and culture and money, frankly, in northern Italy, is because the rice came across the Silk Roads, ended up in the Po Valley in Italy via Sicily and the Arabs, went up, 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 up. Suddenly you got, you know, Arborio and Canaroli? Arborio, at least, yeah. In Milan, which also was ruled by the Spanish who brought saffron with them across up the Iberian Peninsula, across into Milan. And the reason it was in Spain was because the Arabs brought saffron from Iran. So I was like, okay, so these are just all these different things coming together in one dish that is risotto alla Milanese. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't speak Italian, so please forgive me.
That was pretty convincing.
So that's why I was like, I'll just call it alla Bucarese and just be a little like silly. I have a giant pile of herbs
this
here for you.
This smells absolutely incredible. We have dill I'm getting dill. At the top there.
Yeah. We have parsley. We have coriander. I would say we have some spring onions, but we don't. But you could. Did you really want to mix? A big mix of herbs.
Fresh
it doesn't
mix.
Matter what kind. You could do all one herb too. Like, you don't like dill, don't use dill. You could put mint in here. It'd be great. Yeah. I just used what I had, and I happened to have enough. And I thought, Lucy will enjoy this. I will enjoy this.
It.
So we've got a lot of herbs, the sabzi. We've got the beef. We've got the arborio rice, onion, and garlic.
And that's all
we
need?
More or less. We need some stock. And then we're going to do it with a topping of a candied barberries.
Oh, my gosh.
Again, a little nod to Iran. And plus, I feel like sometimes with herbs, too, the barberries, like an herb rice, you want to have like something a little sweet, tart. I think like always works nicely. Mm. And the barberries to me, just again, this is my heritage, sort of, you know, like I'm making something new, but from these flavors and dishes that I've kind of had my whole life, which is meaningful to me. I'm like, oh, this Bukharan Jewish plov is also sort of like sabzi plov. You know?
But I think that's sort of the connections that you've obviously made in the writing of this book. So they really bring it to life. And, you know, they took me from, you know, as I said, being like, oh, I'm so interested that Anna's writing a book which sort of incorporates not exclusively Chinese food, but that is an element of it. And it all sort of reveals itself to be making sense with even your own heritage, which in a way that is feels quite unexpected, and maybe it shouldn't.
Well, that's the thing. I think it was... To be honest, I think it was a little unexpected to me as well. I mean, with that and with the dishes especially, I wanted to make sure that they are a nod to not just my heritage, but to my present, right? Like, what do I cook on a daily basis? What can you cook in your kitchen in Hastings, in London, in Edinburgh, in Manchester, in New York, and wherever, you know? Like, how can we sort of bring these flavors and these experiences into our homes, onto our tables in ways that are accessible while simultaneously like stimulating, you know, not just your taste buds, but like potentially your perception of the food that you're eating and its origins. And I think that so often it's easy to just sort of look at history and assume everything is in the past and sort of things are static now and not continuing to change, but they are changing. Like every day we're getting new ingredients into things. There's no matter what they say, people are moving.
And
we, you know, unless something drastic happens, like borders are, you know, permeable.
Yeah.
And they will be.
Yeah, no matter how hard they try.
No matter, but like, and that's the thing. Like, and this is, you know, was important to me, I think, in the proposal part of the book, is I really wanted to make it clear to people who were evaluating this for publication that this, I didn't want it to just be a book about history and a book about specifically these regions, but more a sort of example of the immigrant story and over time and geography and space. And like that we are, yeah, we're still doing it. And like, that's beautiful and it's delicious. Like, where would we be?
Yeah, it's interesting though, isn't it? Because I feel like there can be a nervousness around talking about and cooking a food that isn't quote unquote your own.
Oh yeah.
Like, did you feel that? Do you feel that?
Yes and no. Yes, because I think that that is a valid concern that anyone and everyone should have, which is to say, I think that you should totally go out and cook cuisines and dishes that are not your own, but ideally with some thought, respect from, or just, you know, an attempt at understanding. I think that for me, it's the fact that, like, this is my food. And as I said before, like, I'm not trying to give you some sort of definitive recipes.
Yeah.
Like, and I, like, some of my recipes start with articles, like the recipe title. Like, it does not say Uzbek plov. It says an Uzbek plov. Like, this is just one of
a
gazillion.
I really like that differentiation, like, yeah.
But it's important to me. And it was, you know, I don't, it's that linguistic difference, though. So this is just one of many.
Yeah.
There are a myriad of these recipes. There are a myriad of interpretations of these dishes. And I'm just going to offer you one because this one's mine. But also, I mean, I am Turkic.
You know, so you're right.
This is also mine. Like, my grandmother's maiden name was Çiğni, my father's mom, Çiğni, which is a designation that was given to people in Iran, you know, generations ago. They were pottery importers, ceramic importers, who, quote unquote, traveled the Silk Roads to China. Çiğni, China. Like, like this is literally mine. But so I, you know, I think the Chinese recipes, I was very, 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 very aware of wanting to, again, be very respectful of the fact that I am not Chinese.
Yeah.
I'm not East Asian. My mom's from Michigan, born and raised white lady. Family came over on the Mayflower, actually.
That's incredible.
So, hey, that means that this country's mine too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But also, her other side of heritage is from Germany.
Right.
So, like, I have a bundt cake in the
in
the book that really was how my mother tried to entertain our Iranian diaspora community in Metro Detroit in the 80s and 90s, where she wanted to make something that tasted like something that Iranians would like. So it's almond. It's an almond bundt cake. But so she didn't, like, mess it up by trying to make an Iranian cake. So she just made a bundt cake. Because she was like, oh, I'm partly German. And, like, bundt cakes are far more common in the U.S. than they are in the U.K.
Yes.
And I think that it has to do with our sort of larger Germanic heritage.
Population.
So it was just I'll just make a bundt cake.
And there's something very, like, quite show-stopping about a bundt cake. I mean, the height and the, there's quite a lot of drama there.
There's a lot of drama. There's a lot of drama getting it out of the tin.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's only show-stopping if you manage to get it out. And I've learned over the years, you have to flour and butter that baby. Like, you would not, like you think you've done it?
Do it again.
Do it again. Otherwise, it's going to be a disaster.
Yes.
But once you do that, it is show-stopping. And frankly, quite easy, actually. You just pour all the batter in and then pull it back out.
As long as you've greased your tin.
I know, you really have to.
All right,
okay,
so we've got
the beef in.
Beef is brown.
We're going to add the garlic.
Okay, great. It's smelling incredible already.
I'm going to add 500 ml of water.
So, what was being cooked in your home growing up? What were you eating things like, I mean, not specifically this, because this is obviously, like, we've talked about the story of this quite specific dish.
My mom learned how to cook a lot of Iranian food from my great aunt.
It's a great story in the book.
Yeah, so there's, like, an entire chapter on Kholajan.
Yeah.
So she came over, it was my mom, my dad's aunt on his mom's side, sorry. Wait, oh, I need to bring this to a boil. Oh, and then we're going to reduce it to low and cook for 30 minutes.
Perfect.
All right. So, wait. I don't want to forget. Oh, I got to add half of my herbs, too. See?
Ah.
I'm forgetting things.
It's too distracting. This is the problem.
I'm going to add half the herbs. So, my great aunt taught my mom how to cook a lot of Iranian food.
Mm.
And in my household growing up, there was me. There was my younger sister. There was my older brother. Older sister from my dad's first marriage, and also my cousin moved from Iran in the 80s, and he was a teenager at that time too. So there were three teenagers and two babies.
Wow.
Uh-huh, yeah. So my mother was very busy taking care of a big household, and meanwhile, her mother was very ill. So, yeah, it was a busy time in the Ansari household, but one that was filled with a lot of rice. My mom made really, really makes to this day, although she doesn't really cook that much anymore. a lot of, you know, just like traditional rice and potatoes, like the gazmak that you, you know, the rice dish that you turn over and sort of have these crispy potatoes, or my preference, crispy flatbread. Oh, yeah. I know. Potatoes is what people really like. And I feel like you see at like restaurants and everything, but you put like a piece of lavash.
Oh my gosh.
Or pita bread. Oh. And it's just like fried bread. It's fried bread with rice. And like saffron and butter. It's, oh man, so good. But then we ate a lot of Iranian food, but only like the same things over and over. She didn't have a large repertoire. She was mostly vegetarian.
Oh,
so she is.
Okay.
Yeah.
But would she cook meat for the family?
She would cook meat, but I don't think she like tasted it.
Wow. So
like, there was a lot of overcooked meat. I remember. Sure. I remember this like chicken dish she used to make that was not Iranian. It was like a stir fry.
Yeah.
That was so dry. Oh. Just because, you know, she's not going to taste it. But yeah, we ate a lot of Iranian food, a lot of kebab. I mean, frankly, a lot of Wendy's also, like some good old-fashioned American fast food.
Yeah.
So as I got older, specifically during lockdown, actually, I started cooking a lot more Iranian food from the Najmi Batmanjli's Food of Life cookbook and just sort of expanding my own repertoire. We'd have these dishes at like different family... Hi, Enzo.
Hey.
Hi, yes, Kitty.
Exactly.
At different family functions or like parties and whatnot, but like I didn't know how to make them. So I knew what they were supposed to taste like. So I just started cooking more and more. Now I cook a lot of Iranian food, but I've had to sort of self-teach. And, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, there weren't these cookbooks available. And there weren't restaurants, at least in the U.S., between, like, sanctions and, like, the fallout from the, you know, hostage crisis.
Right.
It wasn't like Iranians were, like, sticking their necks out to be like, hey, we're over here.
I've written this great cookbook.
No, it was really like you put your head down. I mean, we had people, we weren't like allowed to go to some people's houses because we're, you know, Iranian, which is also fun because then some of the Iranians would be like, you can't come to our house because you're white. So, you know, I had that going on for me. Hubsies! I think it was, you know, a lot of this, I hate to sound like a cliche, but, you know, I had a child. And a lot of, I think a lot of perspective starts to change when you realize, you know, who you are and what your heritage is and what you want to pass on to the next generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is important to me. And my son is not only born in London and going to be raised in London, but he's Scottish. Like, my husband's Scottish. I'm half American, born in Canada, but also half Iranian. And, like, what parts of that do I want to and do I get to pass on? For some people in my family, I shouldn't be really allowed to pass on any Iranian heritage because I'm not like a full-blooded Iranian.
That's wild. It's such and a it's, limiting.
It's very limiting and it's very, but I don't know. And then there's, on the other side, you know, I've spent a lot of time in certain groups of people in the U.S., of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant variety.
Sure, yeah.
Who are like, oh, you might look like us, but like, you know, you're Iranian. Like, so there's like, there's a no-win situation.
Well, thank you for
here.
The reminder that
like,
I don't fit in here.
There's a no-win situation.
Yeah,
and I feel like I've always sort of felt on the outsides of two different groups. And it's really like been a difficult one to sort of reconcile. And you know what? I feel so fortunate that I have both of these sort of heritages.
While we were waiting for Anna's beef to simmer to the perfect level of tenderness, we talked a bit about the movement of ingredients, really the central theme of Silk Roads, which opens with a story about Anna's dad trying to bring back an Uzbek melon, the most perfect melon ever in existence, into the US.
What I hadn't realized in my father's Uzbek melon story of all of these years was that melons actually, you know, come from Uzbekistan. Like, this is where they have been basically born and raised since time immemorial. Like, there are archaeobotanical findings of melons that go back thousands and thousands of years.
That's incredible.
So every single melon that we eat today is basically the progeny of these Central Asian melons.
Yeah.
And so as I did research for the book, I think what ended up being really fun and interesting for me and hopefully makes the book itself you know, enjoyable and interesting for readers and cooks alike is that I sort of looked into where a lot of the other ingredients originated. So my initial thoughts have been like, how did these Turkic flavors move across these borders and across these geographies? But a lot of it ended up being like very ingredient based too. Like spinach, for instance, comes from Iran and traveled across the Silk Roads into Asia via Nepal and presented itself basically as a gift from the Nepalese king to the Tang Dynasty emperor in Xi'an. And that's how you got spinach into China. And it, you know, it made its way down into Southeast Asia as well.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's from Iran. It's from Persia.
Yeah.
So in addition to, you know, the movement of people, you know, you've got these, the movement of these ingredients. And also, you know, what I find fascinating is where these ingredients kind of came from.
Yeah.
Like I love knowing that apples, every single apple, again, that we eat comes from Kazakhstan, basically modern day Kazakhstan, from this like Garden of Eden in the Tian Shan Mountains.
That's absolutely mind blowing, isn't it?
Apparently you can still go visit this like crazy old, like centuries old apple grove. I mean, Almaty means used to be the capital of Kazakhstan, I think means like Prince Apple or something like that.
Yeah.
But just, I think that, you know, for me, what began as a very personal thing became a lot more and a lot more to do with not just like my dad trying to take a melon everywhere, but like people taking apples across these regions and what, you know, different cultures and communities use these ingredients for and how those were similar across these regions and also different. Because as we move, you know, we might be taking walnuts with us from the Hyrcanian forests of the Caspian Sea, but the, you know, Cantonese cookies that you're making in southern China and Hong Kong with walnuts taste nothing like baklava. But we have this sort of movement of people and ingredients to thank for the fact that these nuts exist simultaneously in all of these places. I don't know. I feel like we talk a lot about people's movement and not necessarily ingredients. And certainly, and obviously people are, you know, the heart of it all. The reason ingredients are moving, except for when the boars and the bears are depositing things. It is people. We're taking our culture and our food with us. But I think that, you know, for me, I feel like I've read and heard so much about the spice trade.
Yeah.
How did we end up getting, you know, cinnamon and cardamom? How did we end up drinking coffee and tea? And even like the Colombian exchange ingredients, how did, you know, potatoes and tomatoes and pepper move? They moved because of these giant, you know,
global
powers. They move because of the Dutch, because of the French, the Italians, the Brits, the Americans. And we don't really pay, or we haven't traditionally paid so much attention to what's gone across overland routes in Asia.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
The beef's ready. The beef's going to be delicious at this point.
It is. Well, the beef.
And you've got your pot of hot stock.
I do. Oh, let me squeeze in here if you don't mind. I've got a little baby ladle.
Oh, okay. That's so cute.
I don't know where it came from, but it is cute.
It doesn't
like match any of our other stuff, so I genuinely don't know where it came from.
It's a mystery.
And it's just this like little... Okay, we have stock simmering. We have beef and the herbs also simmering.
Yep.
And we're going to take that off and
check
that out. Smells pretty good. All right, I think we are getting almost all of that evaporated out.
You can see that. It's just getting, when the bubbles sort of start getting a little bit slower. And you talk about that, you talk about when you had the experience in, maybe, I think Shanghai, maybe Beijing, correct me, and you're kind of down this little alley and you experience Uyghur food for the first time. And you talk about eating cumin with lamb and it being this whole like strange experience. Well, it's, you know, strange,
yes,
I think, can have negative connotations, but it was just like an experience you hadn't had before. It was a novel experience. And there was a familiarity in eating these flavors together that you couldn't quite put your finger on, right?
No, exactly. And that was, that was in 1998. Sorry, I forgot. We're also going to saute the rest of the onion. So, yeah, no, it was Beijing in 1998 when I basically just moved there. It was the day that I got my bike that I drove to school every day. No helmet, because it was the 90s.
Sure, yeah.
Barely any cars, because again, it was the 90s.
Green.
But there were not as many like bikes as one, I think, little teenage me expected. We got our bikes and we went down to this what I know now to be in a Uyghur restaurant. Mm. Uyghurs being a Turkic people from northwestern China, and traditionally across Central Asia, their ancestors, the Songdians, used to control the entire trade of across the Silk Road. Like Songdian Turkish was the like lingua franca of the Silk Roads, and the people were the ones who were basically like settled in all the oases. Mm. So they pretty much like controlled the thing.
Yeah, ran the show.
They ran everything. But I didn't know that then.
Yeah.
What I knew was I was eating this food as a teenager, my first day on a bike in China, that tasted like nothing I'd ever had before, and yet like everything I'd always had. There was these noodles that were like chewy and toothsome and covered in this like silky tomato sauce with chunks of pepper and onions. So I mean, I was like, I'm eating noodles with tomato sauce. And then there were these like, so that's, you know, familiar. Mm. But what is this flavor? Turns out it's cumin. And why are there like these chunks of this like fall apart, like tender to the bite lamb in here? And when I eat it all together, it tastes sort of like Iranian food. And it tastes like, and which again, it turns out it's because it was cumin. And I did not know what that was because I was 16 years old. But it was so confusing to me because I was like, why does this taste like everything? Mm. And like, what am I eating? And can I have some more? Yeah. Like over and over. And I, you know, learned very shortly thereafter what and who Uyghur people were and are and why. The why came a little bit later, which is to say, I don't think I realized that until I was researching this book that cumin actually comes from Iran as well. And made its way
and
over.
The line becomes a circle
yes,
once
exactly.
again.
Like cumin comes from Iran and Turkey, basically, and made its way east and made its way into a lot of Central Asian cuisine and into the Uyghur, you know, restaurants in the back ways, the back alleyways of China in the 90s. And now, you know, there's Uyghur restaurants in London aplenty, which is incredible.
Yeah, pass
we can actually,
on the way here.
Yeah, we can get it on Deliveroo. Yeah. I could never have imagined in the 90s or early aughts that I would be able to order Uyghur food to my house.
Yeah, in London.
In London, first of all. Why? Because I could in Beijing. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, back then you couldn't really, there were not a lot of Uyghur people living outside of the outside of China. Mm. And so if you wanted to eat Uyghur food, you know, you pretty much would have to be within the borders of the, you know, People's Republic of China.
Yeah.
And now there are not as many places or chances to eat Uyghur food in China.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're very fortunate that there has been this emigration, and, you know, people who maybe are not able to share their cuisine as easily as they once were in their homeland are now able to do it, you know, on Ho Street in Walthamstow.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to add the rice to our pan. Okay, now we're going to turn this one off. So I'm going to actually switch this. We're going to switch.
Okay. So rice is going in
with
the onion and herbs.
Rice is going in with the onion and herbs.
Okay. So you've, you know, as we've talked about, you've lived in a lot of different places. You've moved around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
As you've moved from place to place and kind of back again and away again, what are the things that you have taken with you in the kitchen, either literally or metaphorically?
Rice.
Right, okay.
Rice. Yeah. I remember my first apartment in New York was senior year in college. This is like 2002 to 2003. And I remember when we were like outfitting that apartment, me and my roommate, and she was like buying like, I don't know, probably like muffin tins or something. And I was like, I got to get a rice cooker. I had that rice cooker for a while. It went into storage when I moved to China, but I just wanted to make rice. And then I sort of figured out how I can make gazmak without learning how to make it on the stovetop, which I now do very well. And in fact, the first day I was able to do that in law school, I called my family on the phone. I was like, I did it! Eureka! I did it! I made the best, like I made real Iranian rice perfectly. But I still have a rice cooker. It's funny you asked that because I was thinking about it yesterday, actually, because I used it to make some rice for my son. But the rice cooker itself I've sort of had everywhere. But really making rice and trying to approximate Iranian rice, even when I was living in China, like I'd be like, how do I make like the gazmak, and specifically not the potato one that I have a recipe for in the book, but the bread one. Like how can I keep making this and like having this in my life, especially and I didn't know how to make it properly. Mm. But definitely that. And that, I mean, just the ability to have something that really tastes like home,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And especially if you have lived in a lot of places, to always be able to do that. And to, like, even if you're far away from your parents or your kids or whatnot, you can, you know, feel comforted by that.
Yeah.
But other stuff, what is, I mean...
Any utensils that travel with you? So you've got a lot of, like, beautiful things in your kitchen. You've got this, like, fantastic sort of textured artwork.
So that's from Georgia.
Amazing, I love it. You've got a spring onion. Is that a kipper? Some kind of cured fish? Not a kipper.
Some kind of cured fish. It's a bottle of Stoli, it looks
like.
Oh, yeah.
Like. Cigarette in an ashtray.
Cigarette in an ashtray.
I love it.
I think this is meant to be an old cigarette packet.
Sure, yeah.
This is a painter. This is a painting from Georgia as well. Oh. Apparently this guy is well known. I have no idea.
Is it an original?
Uh-huh.
Sure.
I met the painter and he was like, no, it's me, it's me. And he showed me his website and he was like...
Oh, my gosh. That's
and
great.
This is from France. This is my salt, like a French tin enamel salt cellar.
It's lovely. On the wall. So
on
nice.
The wall is a little
it.
Spice rack out from the Cotswolds.
Great.
This is a potato. I have things in a potato basket from France.
La Charente.
From the fancy little potatoes, pommes de terre.
Love that.
And that's Spanish strawberries. Great. I like collecting things.
Yeah.
Oh, and this apparently is a Ming Dynasty thing that I've broken.
That you've got your utensils.
Yeah, that's right. You can find it also in the DPS of my dessert chapter, filled
oh
with flowers.
Goodness. Oh, yes.
I love it so much, and I broke it.
How did you end up with that?
I got it at an antique market in Xi'an,
sure.
And I recently showed it to a family friend who is, like, a really big art collector and has an entire, like, collection of, like, Tang and Ming Dynasty celadon. He was like, oh, yeah, that's definitely Ming Dynasty. And I'm like, yeah,
cool,
well,
cool,
my
cool.
utensils live
yeah.
in it, and I broke the handle off. So
hey, things should be used
whatever
enough.
I Weiwei breaks pottery, so
yeah,
can I.
Right.
But and this is an old, there's a sort of copper and silver plate in front of my stove here that is from Iran from the 60s. It's my dad's. I like things that have history
yeah,
to them.
Yeah, they've had a life.
Exactly. And I like my home to feel like it's had a life or is in the process of being alive. Like,
yeah.
We've been in here for 7 years and it's not done yet.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, it's like, it's the decorations are not finished.
Yeah.
And I envy these people sometimes who I see these homes and whatnot where everything is just so manicured and like clean and everything. It's done. I'm like, how can it be done?
Yeah.
You haven't gone on your next holiday. I think I've thought about so much in terms of the book and, you know, the immigrant story is like the things that we take with us sort of metaphorically, right? Like that we carry into our kitchens or in our memories or, you know, in our taste buds. But yeah, there's also a bunch of actual physical stuff that
yeah.
we do take with us that does make it, you know, feel like home. And those are those goods as well, historically, that again, were taken across, you know, these trade routes and, you know, integrated into new lives.
Mm.
I mean, my dad used to just come back from Iran with, like, suitcases filled with carpets and pistachios and dried chickpeas and, like, things to eat, but also just, like, things, like this tray, you know? Like, he would just bring stuff home or, like, these enameled tissue boxes. I just remember always seeing these, like, beautiful tissue boxes that we had. I don't know where they are now, or, like, inlaid tissue boxes. This is what, you know, I grew up around in this sort of very, very hybrid household of, you know, not just cuisine, but decor and items. All right, what's next? Oh, we're just gonna make the barberries. Sorry. Got some
Ooh.
Date molasses. So we gotta do this relatively quickly because you don't want the barberries
yeah.
to burn.
Yeah.
All right. Is this all I want in here? Yeah. I'm just going to let this sort of... Okay, I think we might be ready to taste this.
Oh my god.
To see if it's...
See the texture of that rice.
Yeah. Hello. Tell me how much you want.
Oh my god. That looks perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We cannot forget the fact that we're also going to have some
gorgeous
beef on it. We're not done yet. Some barberries. We want little smidge, couple flaked almonds. And just a teeny, 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 tiny bit of cinnamon.
There we go.
There we go.
Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. What are you going to eat risotto with? Fork, knife, spoon? I don't even know.
Lekker is hosted and produced by me, Lucy Dearlove. Thanks to Anna Ansari for being the guest on this episode. Silk Roads is out now. You should also subscribe to Anna's Substack. Where in the world is Anna Ansari? Linked in the show notes. A little reminder that Lekker is now part of Heritage Radio Network. You can find out more about this network and listen to other partner shows on their website. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Lekker is an independent podcast, which is generously supported by listeners. If you enjoy what you hear and you're in a position to do so, I'd really appreciate any paid subscribers signing up to support Lekker on Substack, Patreon, or Apple Podcasts. Links are all in the show notes. Once again, to any paid subscribers listening here, thank you so much for your continued support. Your contributions help me continue the work and the running costs of making Lekker. So yeah, thank you very much. And thanks to everybody for listening. I'll be back soon.